thank you again for coming.
Okay, I have, I've been having a cough for like 5 weeks. And so my voice is like, I guess it's kind of sexy, sort of like Lauren Bacall or something. But it's not exactly my voice. And if I start to cough, I mean, don't freak out, you know. I mean, I'm not going to explode. I mean, it sounds, with this, it'll sound like an explosion, but it'll be okay. And when you say memoirs or autobiography, well, I've been writing, inventing autobiographies and memoirs forever, but actually this one is in my voice, not in the voice of an invented persona. And whether it may sound a little bit bizarre sometimes, but I guess that's the way I must be, I don't know. But is this, can you hear me? Is it okay? I wrote a short preface when I had to do this in Germany, and why don't I just sort of explain this a little? The book is called Conversations with Stalin, and it sounds very echoey to me. Is it okay to you? You can hear it. Okay. I was what was called in the days of the old left a red diaper baby. My mother was a Stalinist, and though I had a father, nobody ever listened to him because he was just a socialist and everybody knew they were wimps. It was hard in those days. Senator McCarthy was putting people in jail. People were losing their jobs, but we were strong because we always knew what was right. Comrade Stalin told us. Or he would have told us if he wasn't so far away. But there were always other comrades one could turn to, important comrades who wrote for his newspapers and were bigwigs in the party. Sometimes they would travel to the Soviet Union, and they always came back with glowing reports. The workers were dancing in the streets. There was a chicken in every pot. Everybody had a job. Not like here, they spat. No bread lines, no prejudice against colored people. Unions flourished. Jews danced and sang in their own special state in Birobidzhan. A paradise set apart for the Jews so they could sing Jewish songs and dance horrors and till the land and grow big and strong. I had a cousin who was a psychiatrist who was invited to visit Soviet hospitals. He was amazed at the fine treatment the sick at heart received. Not like America, where his poor patients had to pay him thousands of dollars a year to ease the pain of their unfortunate lives. But I also knew an artist who had spent a long life, he was already an old man, doing political cartoons for the Stalinist magazine New Masses. One night, his best friend, a Yiddish poet, just back from a visit to the Soviet Union, told him in an agonized whisper that all the beloved Russian Yiddish writers they loved so well had either been killed by Stalin or sent to the Gulag to die. The old man went home quietly, didn't say a word to his family, went into his bedroom, had a heart attack, and died. He seemed like his usual self that night, everybody said, except that instead of taking the subway home, as he always did, he took a cab. Now, he was a very frugal man of the old-fashioned sort. If he ever took cabs at all, it would only be for a very special occasion, like a wedding or a funeral. Through the years, I too lost Stalin. It wasn't easy. Even when I knew better, it was difficult. I would look guiltily over my shoulder when I said something bad about the Soviet Union. As if my mother were listening. How could she be? She had Alzheimer's. She didn't know Comrade Stalin anymore, or me for that matter. I'm going to start now. And you know what I'm going to do, if this is okay for you? Would you help me move this table? There's like a moat between me and the people. It's freaking me out. Thanks. Perfect. Okay. Now, is that going to affect the sound?
Not sure.
Okay. Did it fall off?
No, just
great. Thanks, sweetie. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Oh, this feels so much better. Okay. I have a whole, almost three quarters of the book is finished, but I'm only going to read you a couple of chapters. This chapter is called Romance. Oh, and I go from, it keeps moving from when I'm a little kid to a teenager, and then I can even be early 20s or whatever. Romance. I start going with Clarence, a communist youth from the Marxist discussion club. He's pretty cute, but I hate the way he dresses. He wears these soft yellow shirts with a silky brown suit. Maybe it's shantung, which is all the rage in the summer fashion magazines. But Clarence doesn't read fashion magazines, and he wears the suit all winter. It's his only suit because he doesn't think progressive people should have more than one suit, and he's setting an example. He probably got it from a thrift store because it had obviously seen better days on a yacht maybe or on a lawn in the Hamptons. There's a dandyish look to him. He kind of flows when he moves in that suit. I like to think he looks Byronic. There's no denying he's cute and he likes me. Given my luck lately, that's a definite advantage. Or I think he likes me, though sometimes he looks at me kind of weird. Like when we drove up, did you make it louder or something? Like when we drove up to my mother's hotel in the mountains, it was, is this too loud? It was closed because it's only open in the summer, but we figured we could make out in one of the empty rooms. Only I must have brought the wrong keys and we couldn't get in. So we holed up in the old barn at the edge of the property. The hay is ancient and the place still had a distant smell of horses, but it was better than bedding down outside where the wind had started to come up and it was getting cold. I suppose we should have figured the day for a bummer and gone back to the car and just made it in the back seat. It would certainly be more efficient, only his car didn't have a back seat. He had pulled it out to make room for the Marxist discussion club when they drove up to Washington for a protest. I always thought mice lived in that hole in the back of his car, but I was afraid to say anything because he'd say I was bourgeois. Since I was afraid he might be right, it bugged me when he said it. After all, I hated mice and went to Carnegie Hall and took showers every day and used hand lotions. But the hay was spiky and it poked me when my clothes didn't cover me, and I thought I saw mouse droppings, or maybe they were fossilized pieces of turd left over from those damn horses. But I didn't say anything to Clarence because I wasn't in a mood for a lecture, though I did think it was easy for him to be a good communist because he was rolling around on top of me and never got punctured by the hay like I did. But he was cute and sexy, so it wasn't so bad. Until we were finished and sat up and I started taking the hay out of my hair, and he said he liked me with hay in my hair, it was sexy. I don't like it, I said, it sticks me. He smiled like some sort of beatific person. I'm so happy to be here, he beamed. Do you realize that this is how farm workers made love for centuries? I'm not a farm worker, I grumbled, but not too loud so he didn't hear me. I still wasn't in the mood for a lecture. Besides, I was hungry. Sex always makes me hungry. But he said he didn't want to stop at a diner. He only wanted to get home. I have to be very careful. I'm being watched. By who? I asked. He wasn't sure, though he had his suspicions. After all, he was the president of the City College Marxist Discussion Club. But Clary, I protested, there are only 5 other members. It's not a very dangerous club. It's not even a noticeable club. He came closer so I would hear him. He was practically whispering. Last Wednesday, I stopped into a bar in McDougal Street, and I was minding my own business, nursing a beer and looking over my chemistry notes when this blonde sat down next to me. He cocked an eyebrow at me and smirked. I wondered if I should be jealous. So, he imitated me? So why did she try to pick me up? I played it cool. Did you get picked up? Are you insane? He shouted, apparently forgetting the crowds listening in. Think. Why would a blonde try to pick me up? What does being a blonde have to do with it? Because men like blondes, you idiot. Don't you think they know that? I pulled at my dark brown hair. So what am I supposed to do? I shouted. Bleach my hair? Is that what this is all about? He looked shocked. Why do you personalize everything? I told you an FBI agent tried to pick me up. I was beside myself. How do you know she was an FBI agent? Jesus, he started pulling his own hair, because why would she try to pick me up? What reason was there? I was frantic by now. Because you're cute, I shouted. Because you're sexy. Why the hell do you think I'm sitting here in this smelly hay with you right now? He was shocked. What kind of communist are you? How can you be so naive? Haven't you learned anything yet? Suddenly he froze and stared at me. What? I shouted. Why are you looking at me like that? Shut up, he hissed. Don't talk so loud. People will hear. What people? There's nobody around for miles. We're in the country. He chewed on a piece of hay and looked superior. Why are you looking at me like that? I insisted. Like what? You know, like you know something that I don't know, that nobody knows, that only you know. He lit a cigarette and I hoped it would ignite the hay and burn him up, until I remembered it was my mother's hotel and grabbed the cigarette and stubbed it out on my shoe. He took out another cigarette and stuck it in his mouth, but he didn't light it this time. If you must know, it has suddenly occurred to me that your ignorance is so profound, it could be a ploy. That really hurt. How could he say such a thing after sticking it to me? Between him and the hay, I felt like a pincushion. That is so mean, I shouted. Again, he looked around to see if anyone heard. He was acting so goddamn superior. Do you think J. Edgar fights with Marcus of Queensberry rules, he whispered. Capitalism is fighting for its very life. What? I started sputtering. God, the whole day was going down the tubes. Somehow we made it back to the car and didn't say a word to each other all the way back into the city where he dropped me off at my house. I'll see you at the meeting, he called out as I ran in. The next day I was still pissed off, but Comrade Stalin said I was wrong. These are dangerous times, little Ellie. We are surrounded by spies, scabs, saboteurs. Unfortunately, they look like everybody else. If they didn't, we would recognize them right off the bat. So they enter our lives incognito. The innocent garbage collector who looks through our garbage for incriminating evidence. The friendly classmate who invites you to lunch. Why is she doodling? Her hamburger is getting cold. You look closer and see words, capital letters, punctuation even. He wags his finger in warning. We can never let up. They are jackals waiting to bite. He leans toward me and whispers, what do you know of this young man, Miss Clarence? I was shocked. Comrade, he's the president of the Marxist Discussion Club. He's a leader of the progressive forces. He stroked my hair and looked sad. Little Ellie, it is so easy to infiltrate the heart of a young girl. She is pure, hopeful. Her arms fling open to life. She embraces the world. How can she know the vast dungeons of perfidy and ignominy that lie in wait for her? Clarence? I couldn't take it in. I have been suspicious of him for some time, he confessed. Why does he appear in your life so often? What are his motives? Motives, I choked. Does he have motives? Everybody has motives, little Ellie. Motives and, if need be, alibis. I just thought he liked me, I sobbed. I thought he was my boyfriend. Ellie, he scolded. We belong to the revolutionary class. We are the liberators, commandos, soldiers in arms. We bring destruction to the forces of capitalism, death to J. Edgar Hoover. He thrust his hand in mine and we marched through the park, heads high, songs of liberation on our lips. I never went to the Marxist Discussion Club meetings again. I never returned Clarence's phone calls. When I saw him on campus, I averted my head and walked the other way. The scoundrel. I must say that what happens is that each chapter deals with another problem. And at the end of the day, I go to Central Park and meet Comrade Stalin, and we walk together, and he, I suppose, solves my problems. This one is called Working Stiffs. I get a part-time job as a receptionist at a startup magazine called TV Channels. The boss is this Italian guy from Brooklyn who made a stir with a new concept he's invented. He gets the weekly TV show schedules from around the country and markets the local programs along with the national ones to a newspaper in every city, a kind of TV guide inserted into the Sunday papers so people can plan their weekly viewing. Everybody thinks this is a great idea. My boss will make millions. He doesn't look like a hotshot, though. Short, schleppy, with a pot belly and a Hitler mustache. A bland, innocent kind of guy. Shy, not good at talking to the smooth financial types who are always coming in. Whenever the outer door opens, he escapes into his office where I see through the frosted glass window that he's just waiting until the coast is clear. After I escort the visitors into his partner's office, he emerges to ask who that guy was before nodding sagely and disappearing back into his private space. Nobody knows what he does there, but he's the brain, so the girls figure he just sits around thinking up ways to make more money. Not me. I think he does the New York Times crossword puzzle. Let me get a tissue. But his partner, the front man, the one who makes all the deals with the financial guys, he's something else. Tall, blonde, with gray streaks. Sexy, the quintessential older man. Yale, oodles of money, a patrician, his secretary Flo boasts. And you should see his wife. I didn't like that part. Who's his wife? What's so great about her? Flo just rolls her eyes. You'll see, she crows. She's amazing. Why, I demanded, what's so amazing? She's an honest-to-God blue blood. You can just die, she squeaks, flourishing her hand in the air in a hoity-toity kind of a way. I hate Flo. She has a big feather bob and pointy rhinestone glasses with the longest and reddest fingernails I ever saw. She laughs uproariously at my bitten-down nails and shows them off to her friends from the fancy accountant's office upstairs when they come to pick her up for lunch. Would you believe she's a college girl, she asks in a rhetorical voice. Then they all stand around looking at me while I make believe I'm getting something out of my desk so they won't see my offending hands. But why would I paint my nails and let them grow long and pointed? My friends would laugh at me, drop me like a hot potato. And on top of that, I could never dial a phone or pull my pants down to go to the bathroom. I've seen them, the way they use their knuckles to do everything. They're like Chinese women with bound feet, only it's their fingers that don't work. The wonder is that they can do everything so fast and so well just with their knuckles. Flo can type 50 words a minute without a single mistake, not even an extra period. I was pathetic with my two-finger typing, but then I wasn't hired to type. I was hired to smile sweetly at important visitors and answer phones and look good. My job is hopelessly boring, and I spend most of my time reading, though I have to keep the book on my lap below the desk so nobody sees how I'm wasting company time. But my neck starts to hurt from looking down, so I have to stretch it in different directions, looking off into the wall and dreaming about my sexy boss and how he'll whisk me away from here to the French Riviera while Flo drops dead from jealousy, and I wave my bitten-down nails in front of her face when I say goodbye. I'll put in a good word, I'll say, graciously patting her loser nails. In my favorite fantasy, I'm Lady Bountiful. I even offer my mother some of the diamonds the boss gave me so she can pawn them to pay off her creditors. Not all the diamonds, though. Maybe I wasn't practical in life, but I'm practical in my dreams. One day the honeymoon will be over and a girl has to look out for herself. And when we come back from Paris, we'll be all over Earl Wilson's column. Though fat chance my mother will see it, she'll drop dead before she'd read Earl Wilson's column. But maybe Anne Cassin would read it when nobody was looking, or Aunt Goldie, who liked that sort of thing anyway. She was a big fan of Cafe Society because she was so tall and thin. She could have been a model if she hadn't married Uncle Irving, the philanderer, who was always feeling me up when I went to his house to babysit. They would call her and let her know I was back in town. She's famous, Anne would squeal. She's in Earl Wilson's column. But I know my mother. She'd spoil it all. Anne Cassin, you should be ashamed of yourself. What are you doing reading Earl Wilson's column? And Anne would be ashamed and apologize and ask mother if she could go with her to sell Daily Workers on Friday, because two heads were better than one, and then they could go to Schraft's afterwards for a pastry and coffee. It was a narrow office, almost like a hallway, with the girls' desks up against each other on one side and the two private offices behind. We'll be going big time when we sell the concept, Flo crows to her friends when they sniff contemptuously at us. And indeed, things were looking up. They even hired another girl. Well, maybe not a girl exactly. A woman, a middle-aged woman. Maybe really she's an older woman, maybe 50. Because despite her bleached platinum hair and heavy rouge, she moves slowly in her tailored black skirt and frilly white blouse like a pigeon. She walks like a pigeon, her ample bosom thrust out in front of her, though those high heels she totters on make her a little unsteady. But she types like a dream. We marvel at her talent. You're great, Gloria, I encourage her, trying to make her feel good. She gets such a kick out of being the best typist in the office, and the other girls are so mean. They laugh at her behind her back, call her Miss Old Biddy, short for Old Biddy, and that nasty Flo is so pissed off at not being the best typist anymore that she's always on her high horse scolding the poor thing for leaving her big plush bag on the desk or taking too long for her bathroom break. Flo is always acting like she's some sort of supervisor, like we work for her or something, just because she's the boss's secretary. Why don't you tell her to bug off, I tell Gloria, but she never does. She just says she's sorry and does what Flo tells her to do. Why, I ask her, who does she think she is? She has seniority, Gloria says. That's important in a well-run office. I respect that. I still felt sorry for her and even went to lunch with her one day, but she was such a drag, scolding me for not doing my nails, ruining my eyes by reading all the time, wearing the same dress every day. I couldn't believe it. She was acting like a mother. What's wrong with my dress? I think I look good in it. There's nothing wrong with your dress. You just wear it every day. That's not polite. People will think you aren't clean. But I don't want to waste nice clothes on this stupid job. What if I need a great outfit for a special occasion? I wouldn't have one ready. She looked shocked. All a girl has is her reputation, she says. Wear it with pride. I didn't know what that meant, but who cared? She was such a bore. The next day I said I was going on a diet and wouldn't be eating lunches anymore. But one Friday there was some weird business going on. The office was in a dither. The bosses wanted 75 letters sent out to possible investors describing the business, and they wanted each investor to get his own letter, freshly typed, no carbons, it's before computers, with his own name and company on the top. I was in trouble. They were obviously going to farm it out to each of us, and I was so slow and made so many mistakes, I'd be lucky if I could pull off one usable copy. But it wasn't coming down that way. Gloria was the official typist of the day. We all sat around and did unimportant things while she typed each and every letter. We were talking four-page letters here. By the afternoon, we had nothing to do and just stood around gossiping, watching her fingers fly over the keys. The schleppy boss stood around like the others, grinning like he knew something we didn't know. But everybody seemed to know what he knew, except me. I didn't know what was going on, except that it didn't feel right for Gloria to be doing all that work. I hung around the bathroom as long as I could, wishing I had played hooky that day. When Marianne came into the bathroom to brush her teeth, I asked her what was going on. Marianne was always brushing her teeth. Sometimes she would sit at her desk and floss. It was kind of disgusting, but she was the only other person there with a brain. She was going to Hunter at night, and sometimes during exams, we'd both be studying at our desks and signaling each other with a loud cough when that beast Flo was prowling around. So what's going on? I asked her. Why is Gloria the office slave? She picked at her teeth and giggled. Don't you know? As soon as that OB finishes up, the boss is going to fire her. What? I couldn't believe it. Does she know? She shrugged. Maybe. Everybody else knows. But why? I insisted. She's such a good typist. Marianne shook her head in exasperation. Eleanor, you are so dense. When I got back to the office, I tried to get Gloria's eye to signal her to stop typing, let her know there was a cabal going on. But I think she knew something was up. By now, the girls weren't even faking work. They were all standing around her desk watching her. She was sweating. It was afternoon already, and she had been working without a break since she arrived. She hadn't had lunch. She hadn't even gone to the bathroom. I brought her a cup of water, but she signaled with her head to put it down on the desk. She would drink it later. She was obviously desperate to finish all 75 letters before 5 o'clock. I should stop this, I said to myself. I should put my foot down, curse them all, tell the poor thing what was going on, make her stop that damn typing. They would deny it, of course. I would become the new pariah. They would probably fire me, too. I needed the job. The hours were perfect. They didn't interfere with classes. It was boring as hell, but easy. But right now, if I didn't get out of there, I would faint. It was claustrophobic. I said I had my period and the cramps were terrible. After groaning a while to make it look good, I left at 3 o'clock. When I returned Monday morning, Gloria's desk was empty. Her typewriter was neatly covered with its jacket. She was gone. That afternoon, the blue blood wife came in to pick the boss up for lunch. She just looked big and blonde and horsey. That Flo was so pathetic. He gave me some stuff to do before he left. I don't know what got into me, but I found myself staring moonily into his eyes, ignoring her, looking like I was having an orgasm just looking at him. Like maybe we were having a secret thing going, only the way I was carrying on, it wasn't so secret. She said something to me. I didn't acknowledge it, just looked into the boss's eyes with our secret. He looked stunned, embarrassed. He didn't know what was going on. The wife made an exasperated noise, sort of a snort. She sounded like her horse, but he was so confused he blushed. I would have rubbed his leg with my foot, but the desk was in the way. They finally left. All the way down in the elevator, she was probably accusing him of screwing the receptionist. She would throw him out, take all his money. The brain would kick him out too. What good would he be without his money? I was on a high. I'd won a great victory. I didn't know what it was, but that didn't matter. I was flying. I went to Flo and told her I wanted my check, that I was leaving. Why, she said. It's a bad time. We're short a girl. I gave her a good long stare. Fuck you, I said, and walked out. Later, I couldn't wait to tell Comrade Stalin about my victory. He looked at me like I was from another planet. And just what do you think you accomplished, he asked. Don't you see, I got back at them. I hopped around with excitement. What, don't you see, I got back at them. I hopped around with excitement. Maybe I even ruined the boss's marriage. Why should he have a silver spoon in his mouth when all we have are teeth? It isn't fair. He looked positively skeptical. Don't you see, I wailed. If they hadn't fired Gloria, they wouldn't have been shorthanded. So, what does that accomplish? Things weren't going the way I thought they would. The way he was acting, I wasn't so sure anymore of how things had turned out. I don't know, I just felt better. I don't want to work with such creeps. Why didn't you call the union and find out if your boss was legal or not? We don't have a union. Of course you don't. You need one. Those girls don't even want a union, I muttered. It's every man for himself in that place. He grabbed me by my shoulders and shouted into my face. That's because you failed to raise their consciousness. Don't look down on them. You are to blame. For shame, you were there for weeks and you didn't move them up into the proletariat. But how? There isn't a single progressive person in that place, I wailed. They're ignorant. They think Joe McCarthy is a hero. Last week, Conchetta even said he was the defender of the faith. He threw up his hands in disgust. Don't quote Catholics to me. Religion is the opiate of the people. Don't you understand anything, he shouted? The workers are like children. They don't know what to do. The foreman docks them if they take time out to blow their noses. He clocks them when they go to relieve their bladders. He points a fierce finger at me. His eyes are on fire. The workers need you. But where? How? I dissolved in tears. Do you think it was easy for us? Do you think we had a roadmap to follow? We improvised. We grabbed at straws. We encouraged, harangued, shouted, jeered. We made so many speeches we had chronic laryngitis. And then one glorious day a ship sailed into port. Tears flowed down his cheeks. He stood very straight with his hand over his heart. The battleship Potemkin, oh, what a ship was there, my friend. A mutiny, a riot. We ran down to the docks. This way, we shouted, shoot your captains, throw them overboard, down with the Tsar, up with the proletariat. He was silent then as the tears rolled down his worn, tired face. He shook his head. Ah, my daughter, think of the chance you have lost, he murmured sadly. There was your Potemkin, and you never knew it. I was too depressed to go on with our walk. I excused myself and ran home and took to my bed with a terrible migraine which lasted 5 days. When I came out of it, the sun was shining and I needed money, so I went over to Aunt Goldie's to babysit. I slithered out of Uncle Irving's grasp and instead of reaching my breasts, he brushed my shoulder. I stuck my tongue out at him when they were going out the door. Why'd you do that, little Eric asked. That's bad. I'm bad, I answered, and don't you forget it. He wriggled with pleasure. So what are we going to play, he asked, taking out his toy bazooka. No, I said, we'll practice making speeches. So what's a speech, he asked. Talking in a loud voice and save your bazooka for the goons. What's a goon? A fink, a troublemaker, a guy who makes a lot of noise when you're talking so nobody can hear you. We'll kill him, Eric said. Yes, I said, let's kill him. This one is called Business. I'm spending the summer as usual up in the Catskills at my mother's hotel. How I would die though to spend those long lazy days dreaming on the beach at Provincetown or Fire Island or East Hampton, getting brown and gorgeous, lying around in a sexy daze, looking up at the guys' latex covered crotches as they pass on their way down to the water. True, some have loose trunks and that isn't so sexy, but it's still fun sneaking looks up at that white lacy lining holding up their dicks. It makes me giggle, like bras. Men need bras. But forget it. Like every year, I'm back at the hotel slaving at my mother's white elephant, the business that manages to lose money that we don't have year after year after year. It's because I started from nothing, she would say. From nothing will come nothing. So I work for nothing, I mumble, hoping she won't hear me, but kind of hoping she would. Uh-uh, she does. I'm in for it. A traitor, she shouts. A viper in my bosom. How can you talk to me like this when I work my fingers to the bone for you? For who? For me? My life is over. I'm a dead woman. Tears run down her face. It's all for you. So you can have ballet lessons and acting lessons and art lessons. So you can go to Bennington and be creative. She cries louder then. She must remember that I don't go to Bennington. I'm at CCNY, which is a lousy art department, though it does have a lot of poets. The middle row of the cafeteria is always filled with poets. So I begin to cry myself. That makes her feel better. I know, Ma, but maybe it's hopeless. The world is against us. She jumps up then. Never, she shouts. Have courage. I will make a success. I will show everybody. The bastards won't win. They can't beat me down. I'll be bigger than Grossinger's. She wipes her eyes with the hem of her print skirt. My guests will be forward-looking people. Progressives, teachers, doctors, modern dancers. And she rolls up her sleeves and rushes out to make her dream happen. Every day is a new day. Every sweepstake ticket is a new ticket. Each new corpse has a new will. But her horse never came in. She never got an inheritance. My mother always lost. But I'd follow her out, bursting with new courage. Her message to the troops, Henry V, that always worked. I'd rush back to the lobby, go behind my desk, and squeeze out what money I could, chatting people up over the phone, writing letters to focus groups, dear, tired doctor, and cringing when new guests arrived and had to pass by old Mr. Burke snoring on the porch. And at night, I ran the bar and filled the Chivas bottle with cheap scotch and served tea in the tea room before bedtime. Then I would play poker with the waiters and busboys into the night and go to sleep at 2 or 3 in the morning, only to be up manning my post at the desk by 8. Good morning, Gerda. Hi, Mr. Horowitz. During the week in the late afternoons, unless the chef was drunk and threatening my mother with a meat cleaver, it could be very quiet in the lobby and I'd grab some time to read. Nobody was in the dining room. The tables were already set for dinner. One afternoon I was reading The Brothers Karamazov and idly wondering which brother I'd like to fuck, Dmitri or Ivan, when the phone rang. Hello, Maud Summeray, Eleanor speaking. A man's voice answered. He had a southern accent, not the Russian, Polish, German, or New York accents I was used to. He asked about the accommodations, what the day camp activities were for kids, then the price for a family of 4, 2 adults and 2 children. Oh, good, younger people. We encouraged them. I gave him a good price. We chatted about the pretty country, how long it took to drive up from the city. Was it true we had concert artists on the staff, that we played classical music? Wow, an intellectual. Mother will be pleased with this one. He sounded like he was about to finalize the deal when he said, by the way, do you accept Negroes? My heart slipped down into my stomach. I was alone in the lobby. Mother wasn't around. I watched myself as if I were very far away. I talked to myself, this is 1950, for God's sake. You're a communist. Your mother reads the Daily Worker. She's president of the West Bronx Emma Lazarus Club. You work for progressive causes. You are against Jim Crow. You sign petitions against lynching. You go to hootenannies and sing Negro spirituals. Come on, Eleanor, what are you going to say? Well, I managed to squeak. Most of our guests are Jewish. I know that, the man answered politely, but do you accept Negroes? I guess so. We've never had any, I blurted out. I wanted to die. I watched myself from far away. What? I cry when I think about this. What was I saying? So do you? I have to think about it, I whispered. I take it the answer is no. He wouldn't let me off the hook. The delicate survival game we played every summer was in danger. What would the guests do? They're leftists, for God's sake. Yes, but would they leave? Would we lose customers? Would Negroes start coming in droves and the other customers leave? I hung up. I was shaking and the phone fell out of my hand. My mother had won. To protect her from the possibility of ruin, I had become a white supremacist, a Jim Crow or a lyncher. I never told her. I knew what she would say. When there was no danger, she would have protected her reputation and yelled at me. How could you do this to me, to my hotel? We're not grossingers. We always accept Negroes. We welcome Negroes. But Ma, you never had any Negroes. So, they didn't know about us before. Now we would have them. But back in New York in September, I told Comrade Stalin, and he yelled at me too. My mother was right. You have shamed yourself, young woman. You have not behaved like a true communist. You do not believe in the solidarity of the working classes. All the workers of the world march under our banner, the white workers, the black workers, even the yellow workers. Yes, I know, Comrade Stalin, the green workers, the orange workers. I love all workers. I would die for the workers. But we hang onto the business by a thread. We live on the edge of extinction. I was afraid of any change that could push us over the edge. See, this is what happens when you become a capitalist. You lose your integrity. All you care about is money. Fie, I am ashamed. His contempt roared over me. I buried my head in my hands. And I will tell you something, young lady. Those guests of yours would have welcomed those Negroes. They could display their tolerance, their generosity. They aren't prejudiced like Americans. They beam with pride, with benevolence. That Negro is so tall, so handsome. Look at him, a veritable Paul Robeson, a Sidney Poitier, a credit to his race. And the wife is so delicate, frail, soft-spoken. A true lady, how artistic. She collects African art, and why not? She is Marian Anderson. But what if they were just plain people, I moaned. What if he had a pot belly and thick lips and wore loud shirts and she was a yenta and cheated at Mahjong and their son beat up the other kids and the little daughter pulled off her bathing suit and ran around naked? He raised his eyebrows and stared at me in disbelief. Well, what then? I finished lamely, crushed by the unfair ambiguities of life. Maybe he was right. Maybe our guests were better than I thought they were. But how could I explain that I acted out of love? I'm sorry. I sold my soul for love. It wasn't an excuse. It just was. I tottered away to escape his wrath. I was a pariah for weeks. When he agreed to see me again, I promised to sell daily workers on the 145th Street subway station for 3 months as penance. And don't leave until everyone is sold, he ordered. Sometimes I was on the platform with my unsold papers until 9:10 at night. Once a gang of hooligans called me Whitey and threw the papers down onto the tracks. I paid for them with my own money the next day. All right, I'm going to read one more chapter. Oh, life is so strange. Okay, this one is called Geography. Both my parents were Marxists, so naturally they were atheists. Ever since I was a little kid, I knew that God never came to our house. We never went to his. Not like the Italian kids on my block. They could never get away from him. Apparently he spied on them all the time, like Senator McCarthy spied on us. If those kids did bad things, they got damned. That's pretty serious stuff. They burn in hell. And that's not for just a couple of days. It's forever. They'll keep burning forever and ever. Would they get all black and ashen and curl at the edges like burning paper? That part wasn't too clear. But I was jealous of the confirmation girls. They strutted around in frilly white dresses like little brides. And when their parents weren't looking, the boys in their shiny black suits would stick out their tongues at the Jewish kids playing ball. Later, after church, they came back and chased us off the sidewalk, chanting, "Me and my friend, the knee, we come from Italy. We shine of the shoes, we kill of the Jews, me and my friend, the knee." So sometime back then, when I was in second or maybe third grade, I began to feel cheated. Who do they think they are anyway, those Italian kids? They're dumb, too. They aren't in the smart classes like the Jewish kids. They won't even go to college. They'll be workers. The workers are good. But they wouldn't be the good ones. They'd be scabs, probably. They'd cross picket lines. They'd be in cahoots with the FBI. So who would be the good workers if all the Jews were in college? All I needed was a Bible, and I'd show them. Unfortunately, we didn't have one in the house, not even an abridged one. We had several dictionaries, though. I chose the blue Webster over the red Thorndike. It was fatter, with gold lettering on the cover and very delicate, almost transparent paper. So every Sunday morning, I put on my mother's heels and a kerchief on my head and hobbled around my room like a little old lady going to church. I would open the dictionary to religious words and read them aloud in a slow, serious, sonorous voice, like a priest or a rabbi. I looked up at the sky a lot to make sure God was listening. First, I read the words so God would know what I was talking about. Then I read the full definition, sometimes a short one, but sometimes quite long. I read the definitions of God, Jesus, church, prayer, sermon, graveyard, whatever religious word I knew. Then I looked up at the sky, put down the book, clasped my hands to my breast, and said, "Amen." A long, drawn-out, sincere "Amen" was very important. It meant the end, period. It closed the book. Literally, as I picked up my Bible and walked out of church, meaning I walked around the room once, then went out the door, put the dictionary back in the bookcase in the living room, and came back to my room to jump back into bed and play with my paper dolls or read a book or maybe feel myself up. Though that wasn't such a good idea on a Sunday morning when everybody was home. My mother could come in and catch me. My family wasn't big on privacy. Back in the shtetl in Poland, my father's father was a famous atheist, sort of like a desperado, I think. Women covered their children's faces when he passed in the street, so he went to America where people had more education and didn't worry about such things. They made money instead. My father likes to tell this story. He's proud of his father, even if he didn't make any money in America. But my mother's father was just the opposite. A great Hasidic wise man, Reb Shmuel Meichel, with a long white beard. People came to him to solve their problems, like the baker's wife who wouldn't clean the house. The baker is distraught. There are tears in his eyes. What does she do all day while he slaves over the hot ovens? Sits at the table and gorges on his food? What are you dreaming about with your head in your hands, you Korva, he shouts. Warsaw? Are you dreaming of Warsaw? Or the brother-in-law robbing the poor widow of her last 5 rubles? He owes it to me, that rotten husband of hers, he rages. He had no right to die. He still owes me 100 rubles. I have 9 children. They don't have shoes on their feet. She is pulling out her hair in despair. They are hooligans, your children. She screams, "Look, Reb Shmuel Meichel, my children, are they not angels?" The tears run down her worn cheeks. "They have only 2 pairs of shoes, 2 pairs of shoes for 5 children. It is a shanda for the Jews. Aren't you ashamed for the Poles to see? My poor Moshe will turn over in his grave. How can you do this to your brother's children, you stinker?" I hear their voices shouting in my head, their hands imploring Reb Shmuel Meichel to translate the word of God and vindicate them. One night when she was very small, my mother peeked inside the window of Crazy Pinchuk's house, and there he was, Crazy Pinchuk, lying on the kitchen table while her father shouted strange words at him. But her mother came and dragged her away. "Don't ever tell anybody," she whispered, slapping the little girl's face for emphasis. "He is exorcising the bad demon in poor Pinchuk's broken body. Now he will go to school and read books like the other children." "Will he do arithmetic too?" my mother marvels. This is a mixed blessing. She won't be able to steal poor Pinchuk's pennies anymore when he can count them correctly. "Please be to God," her mother says, "please be to God." But God is like chocolates. He can explode gloriously in your mouth, but even if you're careful and nibble at him in small bites sooner or later, usually sooner, he's gone, leaving you lonely and forlorn. Some years later, when I was in high school, I remember desperately falling down on my knees when I thought I was pregnant and begging God for help. I don't remember who the father was, and maybe I didn't even know, but when I missed a period, I was terrified the way we all used to be in those days when abortions were done in back alleys with slimy amateurs and dirty knives. Now, I didn't know anything about that, really. I had never had an abortion or known anyone who had, and for all I knew, you could find a decent doctor willing to help a poor girl for $100, but that was a lot of money in those days. I certainly didn't have it. I only got 75 cents an hour for babysitting, and I was saving for an Angora sweater. My parents wouldn't kill me, but they'd yell and my mother would wring her hands and cry. Though if I worked it right, maybe I could taunt my father into hitting me and my mother would rush to protect me while I crouched on the floor protecting my face, and she would call him a brute and suddenly he was the bad one, not me. But in the end, they'd help me to get a safe abortion. I knew that. I was 16 years old, for God's sake. But they had their own troubles, and I was ashamed for them to know I wasn't a virgin anymore. So better all around if God could help. I slipped down to the floor, scraping my knees, and clasping my hands to my chest the way I used to do in my old church days, and begged for help. Please, please help me, God, and I will believe in you and not deny you anymore. I was getting carried away, crying and pleading, rather enjoying myself, when I felt a soaring, passionate rush in my body, and to this day it's still miraculous to remember, but suddenly blood started streaming down my legs and my period came back with a bang. Now that I think about it, maybe it was a miscarriage, but I didn't know about such things then. It's bizarre how much we didn't know in those days. And either way, it was a miracle, my own 100% miracle. I thanked God in a rather noble, grand tone, got up and cleaned myself up and inserted a sanitary napkin into my pants the way we did in those days. And I kept saying, thank you, God, thank you. And then I was in the midst of a moral dilemma, big time. Every bone in my body wanted to figure it was a natural occurrence. He didn't have anything to do with it. He never heard of me. He wasn't there. He didn't exist. And I should just figure I was lucky. Maybe I didn't calculate the time right for my period. I never did anyway. But that seemed like such an ungrateful, almost unmannerly response. It was ungentlemanly. I had called on him and he answered. It didn't matter whether it was him or science. You promised to believe in him. You said you wouldn't deny him. So now that your prayer was answered, God damn it, you better believe in him. There was no other way to keep my dignity, my self-respect. And for a couple of weeks, I stuck to it. But then life went on and I got busy with other things. He got further and further from the place where I was, and soon I forgot all about him. So maybe God came to me once, and it was a good thing too, even if he didn't stay so long. Like visiting my mother in the Alzheimer's home years later, better a short visit than none at all. An even shorter meeting that I'll never forget was with this sexy guy on McDougal Street. He was tall and handsome with black curly hair and a cute accent. He liked me. He definitely liked me. It was kismet. Turned out he was going to NYU and I was majoring in cafeteria at CCNY, where my friends, the poets and artists, spent the days cutting classes and smoking over dreadful coffee. This made him laugh, and he talked about his classes, which I said I wouldn't cut either if I had to pay such serious tuition money. And then he started complaining about the Jews in his classes. There are so many, you can't get away from them. I never know where to sit. I started to laugh. This is New York City, after all. Hey, I said, I'm Jewish. He swirled to face me. No, you're joking. He stared hard at me. I thought, this guy is devouring my face. He's serious. What is this all about? No, I said. This was beginning to feel really weird. No, I'm Jewish. I've always been Jewish, I grinned, and I'm not even in any of your classes. Why wasn't he laughing? Now that I thought about it, I couldn't place his accent. Actually, he sounded kind of Israeli. So where are you from? I yelled as he ran across the street and continued walking on the other side. I'm Egyptian, he shouted and began to curse me. I hate you. Israel should be blown off the map. You stole Palestine. You're a thief, a murderer. What was he saying? What did I have to do with Israel? I'm not an Israeli, I called out to him. Can't you tell a New York accent when you hear one? He continued to curse me and I began to feel really weird. This guy is serious. But I gave it one more try. Hey, calm down. I didn't do anything to any Palestinians, I yelled. I don't even know any Palestinians. And if they're like you, I don't want to know any. I still couldn't see what all the fuss was about. In my world, politics was about the Korean War and the red baiting of Alger Hiss and the Rosenbergs and that liar Whitaker Chambers and the evils of HUAC. This guy was attracted to me. I was attracted to him. What did all that stuff so very far away have to do with me? He continued yelling all the way down the street. Finally, I stopped declaring my innocence and turned around and walked back to the Figaro and ordered a cappuccino. Hey, didn't you just leave with that sexy guy? The friendly waitress asked. Then I realized I was trembling. My hand shook as I drank the coffee, and I spilled some on my white blouse. The next day, I asked Comrade Stalin what had happened. Why do I feel so creepy and angry? He sighed. How many times have I told you, little Ellie, the personal is always political? But I was still jumpy. I couldn't be satisfied with slogans this time. So it's just that our politics are different? That coming from a different place, he couldn't care less about Senator McCarthy and Roy Cohn? Do not disparage geography, little Ellie. Geography is like class. They both cause wars. But he isn't a Palestinian, and I'm not an Israeli. They aren't even our wars. We wandered silently for a while. I reached for a cigarette. I was still very nervous. Look, I tried to explain in more detail. I was treated like shit by some rude creep who was a guest in my country and a guest in my city, and frankly, a guest in my neighborhood. If Mickey knew what a creep he was, he wouldn't serve him at the Figaro. He'd throw him out. This guy could be dangerous. He looked like he wanted to kill me. He should be deported. Good, you are learning. He patted my head affectionately. You have been insulted, dear Ellie. My heart goes out to you. If you were in my country, I would send such a rogue to Siberia. He comes from a warm country. He will languish in the gulag. He will freeze to death. His heart will break in the snow. He shakes his head sadly. That is the trouble with democracies. You aren't suspicious enough. You don't know how to protect yourselves. You let in all the riffraff. But I can't stop. I'm still going at it. There's more to this than meets the eye, even the wise eye of Comrade Stalin. You know what I'm most pissed about, Comrade? That I tried to explain myself. I must have sounded so apologetic. I should have told him to go fuck himself, don't you think? Little Ellie, what have I told you about self-expression? It is wasteful. It goes nowhere. Just report him to the authorities. They will know what to do. He slid his finger across his throat in the age-old gesture. But I couldn't stop. I should have told him that my mother's whole remaining family is in Israel, that her sisters are Sabras who have lived in Haifa since the 20s, that my cousin Amos is a colonel in the Israeli army. I hope they kill that creep. Comrade Stalin smiles and hugs me. Oh, they will, little Ellie. Someday, sooner or later. This fellow will not sit still. He will not spend his afternoons drinking tea and disputing the fine points of art and history. One day he will die earlier than he was meant to, one way or another. Okay, that's what I brought with me. Life is very complicated and ambiguous. Does anyone want to say something or ask me something? Whatever. If not, thanks.